here. Help me welcome Myra Byron.
Thank you. So I'd like to start out by answering a question that someone once asked me when I gave a talk at one of the hospitals. And they asked me, where are you coming from in giving this presentation? And I realized that's probably in everyone's mind, wondering why I came. It wasn't for the speaker's fee, because there isn't one. But it's because I see so much misinformation about there. And my feeling is, as a doctor, you'd want to have information that's accurate. So it's not an endorsement of a product or business today, though there are three new businesses that have been started in Sitka because of it. There's, what is it? Northern Lights, is that right? Greenleaf and Weed Dudes have been started here in Sitka because of a new industry by legalizing marijuana, an alternative to sending people to prison for smoking a joint, which seems to be a far better alternative in my very strong opinion about the matter. So in talking about it, what I want to do is undo some propaganda that was started in the 1930s. And the reason for that is because, okay, there we are. The reason I even care, besides the fact that this product has been unfairly maligned, is that as a physician, I see incredible numbers of people dying or dead of opioids, alcohol, cocaine, amphetamines, heroin, tobacco, sugar, and have pronounced people dead, depression, other serious conditions, but particularly opioids. I won't talk too much about it except to tell you that if you are not aware about the fact that opioids have been way overused in the United States over the last 12 years, then clearly you've been on another planet. Because there are so many deaths from opioids. And if you look at deaths from opioids, that's felt to be by CDC a minimum. And really, this is a bottom figure. It could be twice this, could be three times this, but it's at least 30,000 deaths a year in the United States as we talk today from misuse or even unintentional overdose of opioids. It's not all by people overdosing intentionally or shooting up heroin. Heroin's not included in that 30,000 figure, I don't believe. The total number of drug deaths a year is 45,000 people that are known based on death certificates to die of drugs intentionally or unintentionally annually. Now think about that. If it's on a death certificate, that's a minimum figure. That means there's at least 45,000. That means the actual number has to be higher than that, because somewhere, I'm sure, there's a death certificate about some prominent person who intentionally or unintentionally overdosed on a substance, either prescribed or non-prescribed, and the death certificate said sudden death, heart attack, you know? So there's many more than that, and that's a huge figure. That's a lot of deaths. That's 1 year, 45,000, that is CDC stated. And the number is actually starting to drop a little bit. Some people say it's because there's been more restrictions put on prescribing opioids, which is partly true. But a bigger impact is in those states that have legalized marijuana, they have had a reduction in opioid deaths that is highly significant. Two papers that I read both stated independently of each other that the deaths from intentional and unintentional opioid doses in states that went to recreational marijuana in the first 2 years went down by 25%. Now, I don't know, you may have the view that one doctor told me about, and I'll never say who, but he felt that naloxone was the worst invention ever, that's Narcan, because if someone's using drugs, they're choosing that risk. I totally disagree with that. My feeling is it's our job as docs to save people. It's kind of like playing golf, you know? If you're playing golf honestly, you're going to hit the ball from where it lands. And if you're playing medicine honestly, you're trying to take all comers and do the best you can to help that person improve their quality of life, and if it's their wish, which it is for most of us, to stay alive. That's my job. And I think in many cases, these substances, except for cannabis, tend to impair that. How many overdose deaths from cannabis are recorded annually? None. None at all. So you have tobacco that kills about 180,000 people a year, give or take 10,000, from lung cancer. Not all lung cancer deaths are from tobacco. About 10% roughly are not related to tobacco. Maybe a little less, but somewhere about 10%. But it also causes heart attack and stroke and other cancers besides lung cancer. So tobacco kills more than 500,000 Americans a year. But most people, when they have a heart attack, they don't relate it to having smoked, or they have a stroke, they don't relate it to having smoked tobacco products. So tobacco products are substantially dangerous. Among the propaganda released was a statement that marijuana itself is carcinogenic. In fact, that's not so. It might be that if you take marijuana that has been laced with paraquat, courtesy of a certain Western government, that that might be harmful and even carcinogenic. But if you have a naturally grown herb and you look at the literature and not just take propaganda for it, there's no evidence, in fact, that smoking cannabis, especially occasionally, increases lung cancer or other cancers risk. It may cause some other types of problems, and we're going to get to that. It's not all without its problems. But it became illegal after Prohibition, ironically. After we'd failed in Prohibition, there was a fellow named Harry Jacob Anslinger, who is the first chief of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And he wanted to boost his enterprise's employment and power. And at that same time, the stories that I've read say that William Randolph Hearst, who you've probably all heard of, was, for reasons that are not, that I'm not even going to go into, had a very strong anti-Mexican feeling, which is why we call it marijuana, because it's not even his name. Here we have laws and we have discussions about marijuana, and marijuana is not even the name of the product we're talking about today. It's cannabis. So why are we using this negative slang term that was basically initially associated only with Mexican immigrants, soldiers and Mexican immigrants that came across the border, called it marijuana? So instead of calling it cannabis sativa or cannabis indica, some people feel there's also cannabis ruderalis, which is controversial. No, we're going to call it marijuana because we want to have this thing as being somehow bad, and then we're going to demonize it and claim that if people use it, it causes all these crimes. Now, one of the topics that keeps coming up is, well, is it a gateway drug? I guess I'll go there right to the point. My feeling is there's no evidence that in and of itself it's a gateway drug unless you're using it in an illicit manner. Because if you're involved with people that are selling all kinds of drugs and they're going to want to make money off you, are they going to want to be limited to just selling you one product when they have this whole variety of things to entice you with, some of which you're going to get a lot more money? So my feeling is, yes, if you're involved with it as an illicit trade, there's a possibility it could be a gateway drug because it's putting in with some bad characters. But once you legalize it, there's not good evidence that I'm aware of anywhere that it actually is truly a gateway drug, that people that choose to use cannabis are more likely than people that don't use cannabis to go on to be involved in the illicit drug trade unless they have had some other experiences or are involved with it in some other way. Once you make it licit, you're reducing that whole question of making it a gateway drug, which is one of the reasons why I've in favor of the law. Aside from the fact that you're putting a whole lot of people in jail who are just smoking a joint and costing all of us a great deal of money when they haven't harmed anyone. Now, for those people that are illicitly dealing drugs and shooting people, and you know, that's a whole other thing. But of course, the best way to get rid of that whole process would be legalize it, right? And then they don't have to shoot anybody. They have to just try and get a license, which is a pretty tough thing to do. We have people here that have done that, and my kudos to them for having gone through that process of going and getting all the permits and licenses and trouble to set up a new business here in Sitka. I think that's impressive myself. So they passed a Tax Stamp Act in 1937, and I'll be very quick, but it's funny. I mean, it shouldn't be, but it's funny. The Tax Stamp Act basically said that in order to legally possess marijuana, you needed to have a tax stamp. And the only way you could get a tax stamp is if you showed up with the product to buy a tax stamp. You had to show you actually had possession to buy a tax stamp. But if you had possession, it was illegal because you didn't have a tax stamp when you got possession, so you'd be arrested and jailed because you had the product. So no tax stamps were actually ever issued, to my knowledge. And very few were even printed, hardly any, because they knew that no one would show up to get arrested so that they'd get a tax stamp. It was followed by, in 1942, taking it off the, I spelled it wrong, pharmacopoeia, which is a listing of all the medications and substances that have therapeutic value. And that had been on the pharmacopoeia since sometime in the 1800s. So in 1970, the Supreme Court held that the Tax Stamp Act was illegal because it caused people to be in a situation of being a criminal in order to go apply for the tax stamp, and they threw the law out. Took a while, didn't it? 1970. So they started the Drug Enforcement Association, and they came up with scheduling of products, and that's when this whole schedule of Schedule 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 came about through the Drug Enforcement Administration, which was established at that time. And in the wisdom of the powers that be, they classified cannabis as a Schedule 1 along with heroin, cocaine, amphetamines that were illegal amphetamines that were produced illegally, and many other substances that are generally associated with criminal element. The other thing that made this, that's very important that you realize is that in establishing this law, someone could only do research with cannabis if they had the permission of the DEA because they were handling this illegal substance, which immediately put the kibosh on research in the United States, and that's why Israel was the leading research group for this for 30 years or so. It stopped research in the U.S. on this plant for many years because people were very reluctant to get involved with the whole process. There are a number of natural plants. I mean, why is it that marijuana, which is actually cannabis sativa, is of such controversy? Why don't people just go take some lawn clippings and smoke it? What's there about cannabis that's so different? And actually, there's quite a controversy about that goes back many years, because before THC was isolated, people felt it was a global effect on the body, that somehow this plant had a substance in it that just altered all the cells in your body and made them work funny, and that's how it worked. But in 1988, they first showed that there's, in fact, endocannabinoid receptors in our body, which means we all naturally make cannabinoids, which are alkaloids very, very close in form and chemically in the same family as the delta-9-tetrahydrocannabinol and the cannabidiol and the CBN. Which are naturally in the plant, but they're in our body. In fact, everyone here has endocannabinoids or you'd be dead. All vertebrate mammals have endocannabinoid systems, which means that you're actually using a plant extract very similar to chemicals that are normally in our body. They're kind of like hormones, but they're different. Whereas that's not true of pepper. It is true of opium. It's not true of salicylates. They don't act in the same way that cannabinoids do. So we all have an endocannabinoid system. It was in Israel that the cannabinoids were first isolated by Mechoulam. 1988, they were first described, and then they found we had two types of receptors. There's an argument about whether we have a third type, but no one has won that argument as of last year. And the receptors are very different. CB1 receptors are mostly in the brain and nervous system. There's a few elsewhere in the body, but almost all in the brain and nervous system. And CB2 are mostly in immune cells, which include our spleen, our lymph nodes, our bone marrow, our liver a little bit, pancreas a little bit. And therefore, CB2 is involved with immune and immune modulatory responses, as opposed to CB1, which is primarily involved in affecting our central nervous system. And that's an important thing to know, because some of the CB2 acting products have minimal psychoactive effect, and they don't affect perception the way some of the CB1 receptors do. But knowing that all of you have endocannabinoids in your body that are working at any given moment in the day means that, God forbid, they could pass the law and you'd all be criminals, because right now, whether you know it or not, you're using cannabinoids. They're endocannabinoids, but you're using cannabinoids. In fact, there's recent data that suggests that the so-called endorphin high of runners is actually in the endocannabinoid system and not, in fact, using the opioid system with mu receptors. So it's more likely to be our own endocannabinoids. Now, a point that's not on my slides that I want to just make before I leave, because I think it's one of the most important points to leave people with. There was a product that was passed in Europe and was before the FDA in 2006 called Rimonabant. Rimonabant was known to be an antagonist to these receptors. It blocked the receptors and prevented anyone from having their own endocannabinoids be effective in regulating the body's systems. And the reason this came to market is because it was an anorexic, meaning that it would help people lose weight. And so it came to market, and lots of people took it. And what was fascinating is to see why it was taken off the market. So of all the people that took it, where many thousands of people tried it, 10% had serious psychiatric symptoms, including depression and even some psychotic features. 1% had suicidal ideation, including reportedly some suicides that took place. So the FDA, being slower than Europe, in the end, in 2008, canceled the application and said it'll never come to market because it's much too dangerous. And that is a CB blocker, just the opposite of marijuana. It blocks the receptors from being active in our body. So that says that if you block our own endocannabinoid system, you run the risk, 10% risk of having severe psychiatric disorder or psychotic features, or even becoming suicidal. Something to think about. Our endocannabinoid system is not our enemy. It's our body. It's what we are with, whether we like it or not. And some people argue, well, why mess with it? And we're going to go there. So you have the receptor CBD1. They're actually CB1. That's a misprint. It's CB1, which are receptors in mostly the nervous system, but not very much in the brainstem. So there's no recorded proven cases of anyone taking only cannabis and smoking too much and dying from an overdose. None at all. Because there's so few receptors on that part of the brain that affects respiration and alertness. There are many other receptors that affect all kinds of things. And you know, you may suddenly want a million chocolate chip cookies, but you're not going to stop breathing. So the effects of THC on memory, perception, pain awareness, coordination, appetite, and sleep come through those receptors. I mean, who in this room would be have any interest in knowing anything about memory, perception, pain awareness, coordination, appetite, and sleep? And it affects all of those systems, which is one of the reasons why I am against it being used in children except for epilepsy and possibly inflammatory bowel disease. But again, those are different products as well. There's one before the FDA that I'll talk about in a minute that will probably come to market at the end of this year by GW Pharma, if you are interested in the stock market. It's already overpriced, in my opinion. CB2 receptors are the ones I talked about in the lymphoid system, and they actually have a calming effect. Now, where this is really important, and I tell this to the people that sell marijuana, is that the big thing about marijuana has been initially the concept that a recreational user may want to get really, really stoned. But in fact, if you're a naive user, I would argue that that's a false belief, because a substantial portion of people who are THC, specifically tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the most psychoactive agent in cannabis, a large number of people, and I don't know a percentage, will become very agitated, anxious, paranoid. A few may even feel somewhat, have some psychotic acting behavior, not many, but some, and have a raise in blood pressure, have a raise in pulse, and feel really edgy on a product. And many of those people, if not most of them, won't use it again because they've had a bad experience. There's a way to offset that, and that is to use a lower concentration of THC and balance it with a strain that has CBD, which is a calming effect, and people that take that tend not to have the agitation and the paranoia and the effect on heart rate and blood pressure that's seen in those that use plants that have very, very high THC and almost no CBD at all. So I mention that to the company owners, but also to people.
Out there too, the Marinol product that was a...
Yes, that was a THC.
It's 100% THC, and probably 9 out of 10 patients have all had negative responses to it because it's 100% THC.
Well, it's dose dependent, of course. And so that's why in the elderly I use only a 2.5 milligram tablet. And I was actually at a presentation by one of the leading geriatricians in the country who gave a presentation about Marinol versus medroxyprogesterone for appetite stimulation in the elderly, and he found that Marinol was far more effective than medroxyprogesterone, a lot safer too, for reasons I won't get into, and that it had a much greater positive impact on appetite. But again, the problem with it is a THC analog. It's not made from the plant, but it's supposed to be chemically identical to the THC in the plant. And it's been legal since 1986. Now think about that. If a doctor prescribes it, it's legal. It's kind of like opioids, isn't it? Doctor prescribes it as legal, but if you buy it on the street and it's not through a registered dealer, which is only a very recent event, then that's a criminal offense, something that is somewhat arbitrary in our system. But it has been shown since 86 to be effective for appetite stimulation and for weight gain and reducing nausea in people that are having problems getting enough calories to stay well. Don't we wish we all had that problem? No, we probably don't, because those people are not feeling well either. They're feeling ill. So when you add the CB2, products that hit the CB2 receptor like cannabidiol, that has a calming effect, also is supposed to help the immune response, and probably does. At least the National Cancer Institute believes it does. And it helps reduce that whole paranoid agitation. So what about CB2 in that? In the National Cancer Institute, if you go to their website, they talk about the fact that it is probably effective, though it's not FDA approved for this. I was wrong. You'll see in my slide, which is an error, that some forms of cannabis as an adjunct to treatment with chemotherapy and surgery for multiform glioblastoma are effective in prolonging life, and in a few cases that are very well documented, actually causing cure from glioblastoma multiform, which usually has a 100% death sentence. There's been people that have been using that in substantial doses along with their chemotherapy and actually are getting cured from either glioma or glioblastoma multiform, which has been traditionally 100% lethal. And there was an article in this in National Geographic that showed pictures of CT scans of someone that had taken the marijuana derivative along with their chemotherapy and had a complete remission, and the tumor shrank away and could not be found, and the person appeared to be cured. Now, that's an anecdotal case. It doesn't prove it. It's not FDA approved, and there's not been a good controlled trial so they can go for FDA approval that I know of. But the National Cancer Institute says the evidence is strong enough that it should be considered in patients as an adjunct for treatment in GBM, which is amazing, because that's the National Cancer Institute. I mean, that's the best of the best. On seizures, CBD, which is actually not illegal. In fact, you can get CBD from a health food store, and there are two products on the shelf at a health food store locally in Sitka that are not considered marijuana products because they have no THC and they're not psychoactive. You can use either the drops or for people with bad arthritis, you can use the cream and use it as a cream for massage. And it has, there's right now, we're in phase 3 trials, which is the final trial before the FDA gives approval of a product called Epidiolex, which is a CB2 binder that has been shown in some intractable pediatric seizures to stop pediatric seizures or reduce them, not stop them, but reduce them. And two large trials have been done. The better trial showed about a 49% reduction in seizure frequency in kids that had that added to their anti-epileptic drug regimen. And so there's actually marijuana refugees. I don't know how many of you know this, that parents that have kids with either Dravet's or Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, which are intractable seizures that prevent them from enjoying life, have traveled to Colorado, where they, for years, have been able to get the cannabidiol, the CBD, and use that 4 times a day as an extract from the plant that's THC-free, has a slight calming effect, a little bit of sedative effect. Some kids will cause a little bit of diarrhea, but has reduced the seizures from one, actually several cases, from as many as 100 a month down to 1 a month. Everything else the same, same meds, same lifestyle, same child, but reducing seizures by 99%. And that's not just a single child. There's been different children where that's been shown. It's rumored that some of the kids are becoming less affected by it, but many others have long-term remission. So this product is actually available in 28 countries that is made by GW Pharma. I'm not trying to push the stock or the company. I have no interest. I don't even hold the stock because I think it's overpriced right now. But the product is a combination of THC and CBD to be used for pain, and where it's been approved in virtually all the countries is for muscle spasm in multiple sclerosis. Its results have been outstanding, that people have found it very, very, very helpful. They had one study before the FDA, and the FDA said, well, in the U.S., you haven't met our standards of proof, so we're not going to approve it yet. But it will at some point come to market in the U.S. to be used for muscle spasm and pain in multiple sclerosis, which is its primary indication. And that is derived from the plant. And, you know, it's the old argument, well, if you make it from the plant, is it really different from Marinol, which is supposed to be chemically identical, THC? I don't know. But there are questions of that in other types of products. Because the other question we're not getting into is cannabis one product? Absolutely not. There's over 2,000 strains of cannabis sativa or cannabis indica that have come to market around the world. Over 2,000 different strains. And of those, and besides those strains, there's a huge number of different types of derivatives from that. Altogether, there's 100 different cannabinoids that have been isolated. And there's 200 or more different terpenes. I haven't even talked about terpenes yet. Anybody know what a terpene is? Oh, that's good, because I'd be amazed. But if you did, that's great. I'm sure the owners do. But a terpene is an alkaloid similar to a cannabinoid, but it doesn't have any cannabinoid effect on the endocannabinoid system as far as can be told, but it gives scent and flavor to the product. And that plants have many terpenes, which are alkaloids that give scent to the plant, that has survival characteristics that have helped this plant stay in our society or in our world and not become extinct. So in some way, the terpene gives a survival advantage to these plants, and that's been argued what that is and how that is, and it's different for each plant. But the reason for knowing about terpenes at all is that for the connoisseurs in marijuana, the terpenes are the flavor of the plant. The cannabinoids are the organic effectors, so to speak, that do what it's supposed to do, either psychoactive or to help the immune response. But the terpenes give it the scent. They call that combination of the cannabinoids and the terpenes the entourage effect. Because when you have the natural plant and you're using that in some form, and there's many different ways you can use it, having them all together, the entourage effect means it gives you an experience. And I make the analogy to people that are wine tasters. Not that everyone here has wine every day, but wine tasters have all these adjectives for the different wines, you know, being fruity or woody or whatever, or aromatic in different ways. And so it is with people that know marijuana. Now, I'm not a smoker, so I can't help with this at all, except to say that there are all these adjectives used by people that are connoisseurs about the different strains, and that also lead to some of the names, like Pineapple Express has a scent of pineapple when you smell the plant. Okay. And some people feel that also helps with the experience because it also helps the mood, that if you have a lemon-flavored scent, it gives you one mood. If you have a pineapple, a little bit different. If you have a woody scent, it gives a different sensation to the user. I don't know. You'd have to ask a user on that. But it has to do with the experience. So there were marijuana refugees, cannabis refugees, that came to Colorado to treat their children with intractable seizures. And they left their jobs, sold their homes, and went to Colorado so they could treat their kids, because otherwise they ran the risk of jail to bring the product to them where they were. There's been several articles written about that. There's a great, great YouTube site on Charlotte's Web that shows the original Charlotte when she had seizures constantly and when she then got treated, and show the difference in her life and how much more alert she was and how she was able to feed herself and didn't need to be fed and could walk around and could talk once she had the CBD derivative. And the reason that's so important is here you have a plant that's completely illegal in all forms, or it has been. And you know it's the codicil to this that I told someone the other day. The Tax Stamp Act made cannabis illegal in all forms. You know what that means? It made hemp illegal initially. It's been modified in some way. You can now sell hemp products, but you couldn't sell hemp products. So World War II came. We went to war. We had a navy. What do you think the ropes were made out of? Hemp. Guess what? We couldn't make rope for our own ships. We actually had to import it from Canada, the ropes, because they had outlawed a whole industry with this wonderful bill. The Tax Stamp Act of 1937 had made technically production of hemp in all forms, because that's a cannabis product, illegal. And we imported our rope from Canada because we had a war to fight and a navy to tie up ships. So that's absolutely well documented. That's not a question. So this is a diagram that gives an example of the different receptors, where the green receptors are the CBD1, or CB1, I'm sorry, and the blue receptor is the CB2. And what's interesting is that the CB2 has an effect that's positive on stimulating our immune system and also helping wound healing. Now, it's not been shown in a proven study for Crohn's colitis, which is an inflammatory bowel disease that is very disabling. It can cause constant pain and diarrhea. But there was a study which is not evidential, but it was a very good study, that looked at a large number of people that had chronic Crohn's disease and looked at their hospitalizations in those that used a product that affected the CB2 receptors, and compared 2 years after they started using it with 2 years before, and showed that hospitalizations were reduced by 44% in the 2 years after they went on the product. So this is an interesting plant, because this plant isn't just all about getting high. That's where I'm going with this. I mean, for those that want to get high, my point to you is that if you have a choice between using alcohol or tobacco, which does alter cognition whether you acknowledge it or not, alcohol or tobacco or opioids or heroin or cocaine or some other product, if someone is going to choose a recreational pathway, which I don't endorse because I like to be sober, I like to be able to read and learn more and to be able to treat patients and not feel that that's jeopardized, so I personally don't. But if I were going to, this at least would have the advantage. It's not going to kill you. It's not going to destroy your liver. It's not going to cause you to overdose and die. It's not going to give you lung cancer. Whether or not it causes a problem in the heart if you smoke it is controversial. Maybe it does, but it doesn't cause cancer if you smoke it. And there's zillions of ways to take it, because you can smoke it, you can vape it, you can dab it. There's hashish, there's keef, there's dab, there's oils, there's creams, there's lotions, there's suppositories. You can smoke it as a reefer, you can smoke it in a bong, you can, you know, it's like that old song, right? All the different ways you can take it, they're just legion. And terpenes I just talked about that affect the flavor of the plant and the experience. And it can be eaten. You can just take it and eat it. Now, what's the difference between eating it and smoking it? If you were to smoke it or vape it, but smoking is the fastest, you get effect of the product anywhere from 2 to 10 minutes onset, 10 minutes at the outside. If you eat it, it doesn't have effect for 45 minutes to 2 hours, which is a concern with the edibles, because if someone eats some and they don't get stoned, are they going to take far more until when it finally hits, they're virtually unresponsive? And yeah, that happens. There's people who go to the ER virtually unresponsive. They don't die, but it certainly scares everyone around them because they're so stoned, they said, well, I'm not feeling anything from this. I'm going to have more brownies. I mean, that could happen anyway, just if the brownies are good, right? So that is a problem with the edibles, that they're slow onset and slow offset, because they're gradually being absorbed, they're gradually being excreted. Smoking has somewhat slow offset because it's a fat-soluble compound. These are alkaloids that are fat-soluble, meaning that even though it comes on fast, if you have a very sensitive chemical test and you have taken enough of the product, there are some tests that will detect that you've used product as long as 30 days after using product. So using marijuana in some form or other. So very sensitive tests can detect it up to 30 days after, which is a long time, which is one of a number of reasons why I don't take it, because they have drug testing at one of the hospitals where I work. So I don't try it. I don't put it in my system. But so vaporizing, I kind of am pro on this for this reason, that when you light up a joint, the initial flame is over 700 degrees, though it does go down after you first light it. But the vaporizing, you're actually sublimating the product. And what does that mean in English? It means you're taking the ground leaf or the oil and you're extracting, using heat, the cannabinoids in a gaseous form without burning the product. Because when you burn the product, it's kind of like a crapshoot. You really don't know what you're going to get. Different from a crapshoot, because there's only so many chances with a crapshoot. So it is with cigarettes and with joints, that if you smoke a joint, you're going to get combustion. It's going to lead to all kinds of different compounds. You're going to get tar in the lung, which isn't healthy for the lung, whether or not it causes cancer, which it may. But it's not healthy for the lung to get tars in your lung. But if you vape it, you get almost no tars, 4 to 5% of the tars with vaping versus 90, well, much higher, close to 90% of the tars if you are smoking a joint. So vaping, a lot of people say because you're not burning it, you're also getting more flavor from the terpenes, because you're not destroying the terpenes by the high temperature of the initial ignition. It's 95% there that it reduces it by. So that's not FDA approved for glioma, but it's the National Cancer Institute has endorsed it as probably effective, but it's being looked at for pediatric seizures, reduction in opioid deaths, THC derivatives legal since 1986 for helping with appetite and chronic disease. HIV was an additional indication later. And we still remain the fact that only 8 states now have legal product, plus the District of Columbia. And it's somewhere about 25. I heard a rumor that it was 28 now, but it's between 25 and 28 states have medical marijuana, whatever that means, because doctors don't prescribe it. We don't write a dose of it. In some states where they require you to see a doctor for medical marijuana, you just write a certificate that it might be effective for any of their medical conditions. That's how it is in Alaska, or has been. So, and that just allowed people to have a little bit more of it without getting arrested or convicted of a crime, is what our permits did here in Alaska. But we didn't prescribe it. It's not prescribed anywhere by doctors because it's not a prescription product. Marinol is, which is a synthetic THC, and Dravenol, which is another, not Dravenol, Dravenol is the generic for Marinol, Nabilone, which is Sisamet, is also a prescription item. So, side effects. Motor vehicle accidents can be increased because it affects your coordination and alertness to a degree. It can affect learning. In adolescence, I don't think it's good because of two things primarily. It's going to impair learning. Some people use very high THC strains. It's claimed that it causes earlier onset of psychosis, but I will tell you that high CBD strains are being actually researched as a treatment for psychosis as we speak. And that high CBD, very low THC strains may actually help people with psychiatric disorder. High THC, low CBD strains, not good if you have a psychiatric disorder. There's no evidence that it creates schizophrenia, but it can bring it on possibly earlier if you're using a lot of heavy use of high THC strains. Several papers suggest that. So it's not good because it also interferes with some of your degree of interpersonal learning. One of the most complex skills we have, one I wish I was more perfect at, is relating to other people in organizational and individual situations. So always say the right thing, to do the right thing. It's a really tough skill that few people do well. We all do it to some degree, better or worse, and yet we'd all like to do it better. And yet when you're stoned, you're not going to learn the best ways to do that because you're stoned, which is one of the other issues about adolescents not using it, because it's going to impair their developing those interpersonal skills as well as cognition and not doing as well in learning new information. So those are some of the indications that it is used. It is effective in glaucoma, but there's a problem with it. And if you smoke a joint, the time in which it lowers intraocular pressure is between only 3 to 3.5 hours. So that means you'd have to be stoned continually. You have to use about 8 joints a day to effectively treat your glaucoma around the clock. It means you have to set an alarm at night and get up, get some smoke. So that would be a bit of a problem, which is why even though it is effective for glaucoma, it's not the best treatment for it. But it has been used by some people that have used 7 joints a day to treat their glaucoma. And that there's some studies on that are interesting. Traumatic brain injury, the one that should leap out if you've not even thought about it, because of its impairment on the hippocampus and short-term memory and short-term learning and integration of information, it actually may have an adjunctive helpful effect if given in the first 48 hours after traumatic brain injury, in that by stimulating the endocannabinoid system, it may reduce, in fact, there's several studies that claim this, that it reduces the severity, intensity, and frequency of PTSD following a severe traumatic injury. And that's being studied by the military as we speak. There's a number of better studies going on, but the suggestion that if it's used acutely in the first 48 to 72 hours, it may reduce the intensity of PTSD after traumatic brain injury. It won't necessarily improve the function from TBI, but it may reduce some of the severity of psychiatric side effects from severe trauma. So with all of that said, which is a heck of a lot of information, if you've caught your breath yet, and I'll catch mine, any question that I can answer? They study all kinds of things that aren't FDA approved. I mean, they've been using transemic acid for trauma in their system for 15 years, and it's still not legal in the United States, even though there's the Maryland Shock Trauma now is using it in a trial. So as an example, the military can do things the rest of us can't, including even academics, because they are a different system. So they have done all kinds of things through the years that are not done in conventional life, whether they're legal or not.
But it's only recently that they're recognizing
Well, we can't actually prescribe it. In states where there's medical marijuana, we can sign a permit. But technically, I was told that we can't do that. I work in the VA. Because it's not FDA, because it's not approved by the feds, I was told that we should not do that in the VA system. So that's what I was told by my department chairman.
Coming close to being able to do that. So I guess I'm wondering if they can do studies on it. Why can't they just go ahead and take that next step?
Well, once the studies are done, they could. Yeah. But the studies are not conviction. A lot of studies, not just in studying cannabis, but if you spend a great deal of time looking at how research is done, which I probably spend far too much time at that. An awful lot of studies are really quite lousy. They don't specify enough about it. For instance, if they said they used cannabis and it had this great result, that wouldn't be, in my opinion, even publishable, though it might get published, because 3/4 of the studies that I read don't say what strain they used. Well, what's the strain THC? What's the strain CBD? What serum level was there? Well, how much did they actually take? Did they eat it, chew it, smoke it, vape it? And when they did, what was their serum level? So how do you really know, unless you're doing some of these things, what the product is doing or how much of it is placebo effect? Because placebo effect's powerful stuff. It's very, very powerful. So if you really want to know if you're doing something worthwhile, there's a proper way to do a study, but very, very few studies are done properly in all of science, not just medicine, in all of science.
Do you ever see, like, the CBD oil, or maybe it is, covered by insurance? My cousin's child's autistic, and they're finding that CBD oil works and reduces those seizures that he has, but they can't afford it.
Once a Pedialyx comes to market and it's FDA approved, which will happen, should happen the last part of this year or early next year at the latest, then at that point, and it's going to happen because the studies are there have been 2 studies already published that are strongly positive. At that point, then, once it's FDA approved, the insurances will have to cover it. Until then, they don't, because it's still experimental. And they don't have to cover experimental therapy. And it is expensive. It's a fresh extract from the plant that they're trying to get the pure CBD. It's an oil extract of some kind that they try and get the pure CBD and have. Actually, they use carbon dioxide in the best method to get organic CBD. So it is expensive. And once a Pedialyx comes out, then there will be an FDA-approved product that they estimate will sell on retail for it'll be about $30,000 a year for CBD for a child with intractable seizures. But it'll be coverable under insurance because it'll be FDA-approved. That's where that stands. It's definitely a problem because the cost is huge. I mean, that's a cheap drug, isn't it, nowadays, compared to the oncology drugs? Yeah. Compared to a lot of the drugs for cancer, I mean, that's actually relatively cheap, but it's a lot of cost to making it. That's a great question, though. Thank you. Anything else? But thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for putting that together and coming.
Sure, you're welcome.
We have a couple announcements. On the 30th, mark your calendars, Silver Basin is hosting a business after hours. And it's from 5 to 7, and there's something to eat and opportunity to network with our chamber members and invited guests. If you know someone that might want to join, please bring them and let them hear about what we are doing. Also, our Silver Saver advertising deadline is coming up. It's actually today. We'll be doing new cards that will be printed and distributed April 1st, and we already have a couple new advertisers, so really excited about that. Some really exciting specials that we'll have on that card, and so if you're interested, please stop and talk to me. We'll get you on the card. Next week, we have Sitka's annual health report card. Doug Osborne from Sitka Community Hospital will be here. We did have a last 50 claims reschedule there. And on April 5th, we'll have Alaska State Chamber CEO Curtis Thayer will be here. They're doing a site visit for their October convention, and he'll be here to give an update and talk about some of the state chamber's priorities. So be sure to mark your calendars for next week, and we'll see. Thank you all for coming.
Do you want this back?
Well, before you take off.
Yeah.
Addiction, habituation, and, you know, it seems like some people just get totally lost to pot like they do alcohol in a way. Is there anything that suggests that you can just get too deeply in?
It can be habit forming. About, if you look at all comers, about 9% of people may become heavy users after initiating with this, so that is a problem. But I've seen people addicted to Benadryl, where they can't function if they don't take it, not because of allergies, because they're used to taking it. But it is still, it is habit forming. It does have that potential, and about, but it's much less than the other substances. And it has a much lighter withdrawal because there's no life-threatening withdrawal from cannabis, no matter how heavy you're using it. But it there is a withdrawal syndrome of irritability, craving, and difficulty with life by coming off the product. It's not free of withdrawal either. So yes, that's definitely a problem of habituation or addiction. And it is mildly addicting in that if you have all these high levels and you're a heavy user and come off it, then you'll be irritable and crabby, and a lot like coming off cigarettes. You know, not, you won't be chilling. So that's true. That is a problem with it.
Where they